This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Alfred McCoy about his new book, Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation.
Professor McCoy documents beyond refutation that the United States has been involved in the development and perfection of torture through the CIA since the 1950s. And he indicates that there have been six cycles of exposure of this torture and then the burying of it from back in the 1970s up until today under Obama.
We'll hear how the Boston Police Department has been working with its local fusion center to spy on the lawful activities of protesters.
A recent report by the National Lawyers Guild and the American Civil Liberties Union details the consolidation, really, of the various police state arms in Boston, but it's an indication of what's happened nationwide since 9/11.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi, the Supreme Court has finished its term, and they decided a case on qualified immunity called Reichel versus Howards, which led off two Secret Service agents, let them off the hook after they went after and had arrested a guy who said something to Dick Cheney. What did he say and what happened?
Michael, this actually dates back to 2006. Cheney was shaking hands at a shopping mall in Beaver Creek, Colorado, and Stephen Howards got in line. When his turn came to shake Cheney's hand, he said to him, "The Bush administration's policy in Iraq were disgusting." Howards and a couple of the Secret Service agents said that he lightly patted Cheney on the shoulder, but other agents say it was more of a so-called forceful push. Agents approached Howard, asked if he touched the vice president, and he said no. On that denial, he was arrested for lying to federal agents and for assaulting the vice president. So this case happened. Howard filed a lawsuit contending the Secret Service arrested him in retaliation for expressing his political viewpoints, and that the Secret Service saying he allegedly lied was in fact an after-the-fact justification for arresting him.
And he told the Secret Service, quote, "If you don't want other people sharing their opinions, should have Cheney avoid public places." Anyway,
so he
sued for this false arrest. The Supreme Court said that it was okay because conceivably Howard had threatened Cheney, and these Secret Service agents have to make these on the spur of the moment decisions to protect the safety of the guy, and therefore they put him away. So he tells Cheney the truth, that he is disgusting, and this is what he gets for his trouble.
And it's worth noting, Michael, that this was an 8-0 decision. Kagan did not take part in the ruling, but it shows the force of this national security apparatus.
Yeah, exactly.
Michael, we've talked so much on Law and Disorder about the use of undercover agents preying on vulnerable individuals and getting them to do the work of the FBI, the NYPD. We have a current case involving a 19-year-old American of Bangladeshi descent.
The 19-year-old got busted three times on petty marijuana charges, so the New York PD turned him into what they call a mosque crawler. That is, he went around to mosques and universities and other places, and he was supposed to do, what do they call it, Heidi?
It's called create and capture.
Create and capture. What does that mean?
Well, it means that the individual now working for the police will start up a conversation about jihad or terrorism, then capture the response to relay right back to the NYPD.
And for this, he was paid about $1,000 a month.
And got goodwill from the police after his minor marijuana arrest.
You now walk around with the only legalized dope in New York this kid's got. Anyway, so he did a good job for him. He even said he got creative because that's what they liked. So they would pay him money if he made stuff up. This is, of course, what happens with informants. And he went to mosques. He photographed lists of people who would come to the mosque. He photographed people people and their faces at the mosque. He went to universities when Muslims were speaking to student groups, kept track of that. There's even a report that he was up at Yale. I mean, the New York City cops are up and down the East Coast. They're not
exactly.
just New York City.
Well, then, Michael, you know, what happened was he mentioned this to his friends. He shared some details about his work for the police, and then he even told the police handlers that the Associated Press had contacted him. And all of a sudden, he stopped receiving what had been regular text messages from his NYPD handler, Steve, and the handler, Steve's phone number was disconnected.
Rahman finally saw the light of the day and now denounces what he had done as being unconstitutional. And not only that, it's specifically illegal under the Hanshew decision here in New York City, Heidi. Explain what the Hanshew decision was supposed to control and why the cops are just ignoring it.
Well, Hanshew brought in the name of plaintiff Barbara Hanshew and other activists over 40 years ago, is really an important case that sets limits on police spying on political activism.
Paper trail. The cops got to write down what they find out. And they're not supposed to just spy on a public meeting and then keep a record of it. They're not supposed to do
that. Unless there's, suspicion of criminal activity.
Yeah.
But the problem with Hanshew, Michael, as many listeners know, is that over the years, and really accelerated after the events of 9/11, the NYPD has pushed aggressively to loosen it and really take the bite out of it, so that they've made exception after exception, just like other what are called consent decrees across the country, that were formed basically after it became public knowledge that the FBI and even the CIA was spying unlawfully on American citizens. So Hanshew is a weakened consent decree. And I think it's worth noting that the NYPD spying programs were built with the unprecedented help from the CIA.
Well, they hired, the number three guy in the CIA, a guy named Cohn, to head up police spying in New York City.
The intelligence division, right.
Yeah.
On a final note, though, we should say, Rahman, who hails from Queens, initially thought that what he was doing was important to protect the city. He viewed himself kind of as a hero, and he said he never witnessed any criminal activity or saw anyone do anything wrong.
We are delighted to welcome back Professor Alfred McCoy, who's a professor of history at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, to talk about his new book, Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. Torture, the application of extreme pain and isolation to destroy the integrity of the person, is a classic human rights issue. The method is physically brutal, but the point is often psychological, dread, degradation, and inner shattering. In Professor McCoy's book, he reveals the conditions that give rise to the torture and the mechanisms that permit impunity. He breaks new ground by analyzing psychological torture as such and by tracing the role of U.S. officials, the CIA, and scientists in its development from the 1950s to the present. As Michael Ratner has noted, McCoy is our finest thinker on the issue of torture. He describes its legalization under Bush and the damage caused to morality, law, and our future by Obama's granting of impunity to the torturers. Readers of Al McCoy's book, Torture and Impunity, will come away with the understanding that the United States' commitment to human rights was tested by 9/11, and it failed.
Welcome, Professor McCoy, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. Happy to be here.
Al, the CIA has developed and used torture over the decades since the 50s, and not just in Iraq or Guantanamo. You detail this really extraordinarily, irrefutably in your book, Torture and Impunity. And I wondered whether you could start off our interview with giving the listeners a little history lesson in a nutshell of where the CIA has used torture, how it developed, and give us a picture of its really global reach.
Sure. Most Americans think of torture as an issue involving the United States, and I think the history starts on September 12, 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks. Actually, it goes back 60 years earlier, not to the start of the War on Terror, but the start of the Cold War. And at the start of the Cold War, the communists, the Soviet Union, staged some show trials in Eastern Europe with Protestant pastors and a prince of the church, a Catholic cardinal in Hungary, standing up and giving automaton-like confessions as if they had been brainwashed. That raised alarm bells in Washington, because it's hard to remember this now, but at that time in the 1950s, the human mind was sort of the last continent to be discovered, okay? It was this vast, unknown terrain. And people in Washington, in security and CIA, were concerned that the Soviet Union was capable, for example, of programming people to do things against their will. So initially defensively, and very quickly offensively, the CIA led the U.S. intelligence community, and indeed our close allies, the British and the Canadians, in a massive search that lasted 12 years for sophisticated mind control techniques. And it went through a first phase of exotic techniques where they explored hypnosis and, very famously, almost notoriously, drugs. And that led to absolute dead ends, didn't produce anything. But they outsourced the mundane behavioral research to top-ranking cognitive scientists. And this produced two breakthroughs. One, a very famous Canadian psychologist named Dr. Donald O'Hebb, working for the Canadian National Defense Council in collaboration with the CIA, discovered something called sensory deprivation. He found that by putting medical students at McGill University, where he was chair of psychology, in very comfortable air-conditioned cubicles with goggles, gloves, and earmuffs, that this sensory deprivation, which became sensory disorientation, produced extreme hallucinations, and then in a number of cases, a breakdown akin to psychosis. The other discovery came from two researchers, scientists at Cornell University Medical Center in New York City, who were given access to CIA files on KGB torture techniques, Soviet intelligence torture techniques, and they discovered that the KGB's most devastating torture technique was not crude beatings, but simply having the victim stand motionless for days on end. And it turned out the legs would swell, hallucinations would set in. This would all become incredibly painful. We now call this stress positions. And these two techniques, self-inflicted pain and sensory disorientation, were combined in the CIA's QBAR counterintelligence interrogation manual in 1963. And they were disseminated within the U.S. intelligence community, and then through a bunch of CIA blinds, then international police training, to U.S. allies worldwide, leading to a global proliferation of torture on our side of the Iron Curtain. And this persisted throughout the Cold War. It reached a peak in Vietnam, where the CIA's Phoenix program had 40-plus interrogation centers across the country that used this and actually more brutal techniques that produced 41,000 extrajudicial killings and countless tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of tortures in a vain attempt to break the Viet Cong. These lessons were then brought to Central America during the 1980s. And when the Cold War came to a close, the U.S. momentarily disarmed and stopped those techniques. We rescinded the torture training for our Latin American allies. The CIA stopped using those techniques. And that all changed basically when the campaign against Al-Qaeda started in the mid-1990s under President Clinton. Two things happened under President Clinton. One, the United States, after much of a delay, finally ratified the UN Convention Against Torture, but we did it in a way that split the convention down the middle. The UN Convention barred with equal weight physical and psychological or physical and mental torture. And the way the U.S. ratified the convention is we twisted the UN language very subtly but very skillfully, so we effectively exempted the torture techniques which the CIA had been developing with such care for the previous 30 years. Then the other thing we did, which was a blatant defiance of the UN Convention, is when President Clinton launched the counterterror campaign against Al-Qaeda in 1995, there were 70 renditions, which even under the terms the United States ratified the UN Convention Against Torture, we agreed to prohibit, but we did it anyway. That's to say, we illegally took people, seized them, and transferred them to allied nations where they would be likely to be subjected to torture, as indeed they were. And Egypt was particularly brutal and a favorite location for U.S. rendition. And that was the state really right up until September 11, 2001.
During this early period, these several decades, was there any outcry about the fact that the medical profession and the therapeutic communities were cooperating and helping develop and examine the efficacy of certain torture techniques?
No, because almost all of the people doing the research were doing it through blinds. What the CIA did very cleverly was it routed, it had a kind of a blind system. For example, one of the favorite blinds for the CIA was the Office of Naval Research, okay, so that they would give the money to Office of Naval Research, which then in turn would give it to a university or a hospital. So the nominal contracting party was the Office of Naval Research, not the CIA. And then the results were often delivered in two forms. One, a kind of classified report that would go to the U.S. Army or the Navy or ultimately to the CIA. And then there would be, because these are academics and they got to publish in order to get promoted and advance their reputations, they would then publish the results in sort of slightly sanitized form. And it's only retrospectively we've been able to cover a bit of the trail of research. And even now, it remains enormously controversial and much of it concealed. So, no, it didn't really come out at the time. The other complicating factor for this as well, this offensive research, which was launched in 1950 and continued right up to the writing of the Kubark Manual by the CIA in the early 1960s, also developed a defensive dimension. After American POWs came back from Korea, where about 30 pilots who had been subjected to brutal tortures but had been subjected also to something akin to brainwashing, they made allegations. They accused the United States on Radio Beijing of war crimes, particularly germ warfare in Korea. And when they came back and they were investigated, there was a court-martial from a senior Marine Corps pilot who had made the most detailed allegations. It was a spectacular public court martial in Washington, D.C., and President Eisenhower in 1955 ordered that any American soldier likely to be captured by the enemy must be trained and conditioned to resist torture. And so the same offensive techniques we've been developing, we flipped them and made them defensive, and they became incorporated from the 1950s up to the present day in what's known as SEER training, survival, evasion, resistance, escape, which almost all American pilots, because they're likely to be shot down behind enemy lines, they're given SEER training. They're put through these kinds of techniques. That meant that once we disarmed ourselves, if you will, in the aftermath of the Cold War, we recalled the torture training manuals from Latin America, we stopped the torture training, the CIA stopped using those techniques, there was about a 10-year hiatus, which in a bureaucracy is a generation. And that meant that when September 11th came around, there was nobody really around anymore in the CIA that had been trained in these techniques. And the training had been, in the 1970s and 80s, had been quite extensive. They were all gone. And so the sole institutional memory for this research was the SEER training. And that's when the CIA contracted two top Air Force SEER trainers to reverse engineer these defensive techniques and use them actually for what turned out to be their original offensive purposes on the detainees. And so those techniques came back. After 9/11, they were surfaced first in upgrade prison, but they've been used in Guantanamo, they've been used in Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, and in CIA safe houses around the world. There were, after 9/11, President Bush authorized the CIA, and this is a real change. He authorized the CIA to open up its own prisons, lease its own fleet of executive jets in order to render people, move them around from prison to prison. So for the first time, the United States under President Bush actually ran its own prisons. We actually had CIA agents dirtying their hands with wall slamming and waterboarding, doing these techniques. In the past, we'd developed the techniques, we'd trained our allies, but we outsourced the torture. the prisons, even those in Vietnam and the Phoenix program, were nominally under the control of the South Vietnamese police force. It was mainly South Vietnamese interrogators. We simply outsourced it and then harvested the intelligence, gave them the techniques, gave them the funds to build the prisons. They did it, so we weren't directly implicated in them, harvested the intelligence. What's distinctive about the Bush era is that we actually did it. We were actually torturing.
That brings us to a central concern of your book, Professor McCoy, Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. We're speaking with Alfred W. McCoy from the University of Wisconsin, who's written this absolutely crucial, important book, extremely well documented. There are 15 pages of bibliography, extensive footnotes, and it leads to this question. Why has the CIA been successful, as you write, in define investigation, prosecution, and prohibition of torture? That's a big question, but how do you grapple with that? You know, it's the question of impunity.
Yes, right. It's not just the CIA. It's the lawyers inside the Bush administration, the Office of Legal Counsel, and the White House that wrote the memos and advised the agency that these techniques, which I think stand under international law and under U.S. treaty commitments, as torture, that somehow these techniques were legal. So it's the CIA, the lawyers inside the administration, and then senior administration officials under President Bush. They're all implicated in this process. How do they all achieve impunity for the crime of torture? There's two parts, I think, to the answer. One is a general process inside the United States through media, mass media, in which torture became normalized for the American people. And then there's an actual specific political process over the past 4 years of impunity. Let me address, first of all, the critical element of the normalization of torture. Most Americans are aware that vaguely after 9/11, there were shows like 24, there were movies like Casino Royale and The Passion of the Christ that sort of had torture, but they don't realize is that through the invisible tendrils that tie mass media to the state in any modern society, okay, the administration, the Bush administration, kind of signaled very directly the American mass media, just as they once signaled we're going to all fight drugs under Ronald Reagan and back in the 90s. Now, torture's okay. And so suddenly, intuitively, torture became omnipresent on screens large and small across America. The Parents Television Council said that in the 4 years prior to 9/11, there were about 20 incidents of torture a year on broadcast television in the United States. In the 5 years after 9/11, there were about 150 incidents a year shown on broadcast television in the United States. And the context changed. Before 9/11, the people that torture were bad guys like Nazis and Gestapo, okay? After 9/11, they were heroic federal agents like Jack Bauer on the show 24, who were using torture to defend America and save American lives. The show 24, okay, which became enormously popular with 12 to 15 million viewers per incident. The show 24 had 67 portrayals of torture in the first five seasons that it was broadcast. And in every case, what would happen is the heroic fictional agent Jack Bauer would be in some crisis situation, there'd be a ticking time bomb about to go off, a nuclear bomb about to detonate in Los Angeles. He would torture some malefactor, extract the information, and stop the atrocity. And then the highest grossing of the 21 Bond films, Casino Royale, has a lurid a sexual torture scene with the actor Daniel Craig playing James Bond stripped naked and beaten about the genitalia in a really homoerotic scene that, although it's kind of brutal, is also darkly sexually enticing. And then the World of Warcraft, when it came out in 2008, it had a neural needle to torture an evil sorcerer in the game. That game sold 3 million copies in the first few days of its release, you know? So on screens large and small, torture was normalized for Americans, and the results are very clear. Now, recent surveys show that approval for the most harsh of American torture techniques, naked and chaining and waterboarding, doubled from 2005 to the present. Back in 2005, about 60% thought these techniques were acceptable. Now it's about 30% think these techniques are acceptable. In other words, it's doubled. Okay, so that's the general context. We've had torture normalized through the effect of mass media. But then there's a process that's taken place over the last really 5-6 years in which we've gone through a 5-step process to impunity for the crimes of torture. And it's a universal process that you find in almost every country around the world that's emerged from the trauma of torture. And on both sides of the Iron Curtain, in Latin America, in Southeast Asia, in Eastern Europe, nations were under authoritarian regimes. They had, you know, internal secret police that were doing these tortures. And so this process of impunity is really a transnational or international process, and it's quite similar. In the American case, it's even more extreme. The impunity is even more perfect than it is in most places around the world. And here it started with, first of all, right after the Abu Ghraib photos came out in 2004, step one is blame the bad apples. Donald Rumsfeld said this was the work of a few low-ranking soldiers. William Safire in the New York Times banded these people as creeps. The dozen or so investigations by the Pentagon all came to the bad apple conclusion. President Obama himself said this as well in 2009. The next step, and this is a bipartisan process, the next step is national security. All right, this was Dick Cheney. He has, throughout the Obama administration, has appeared on television numerous times saying that these enhanced techniques, a euphemism for torture, save thousands, sometimes he says hundreds of thousands of lives. So in other words, they were necessary for our national security. The third step is a process, a product of President Obama's statements. In April 2009, when he visited CIA headquarters, he said that this happened in the past, and we now needed to move forward together. And it was a clear signal to the CIA that he wasn't going to prosecute them. The fourth step is one that we've gone through basically over the past 2 years, and this has been the work of Republican neoconservatives, top officials of the Bush administration, conducting a counterattack against the Obama administration's reforms, seeking not just impunity, but vindication. Dick Cheney and his daughter Liz Cheney have been very aggressive in this regard. And indeed, ironically, in May of 2011, May of last year, when Osama bin Laden was killed under President Obama's orders, a kind of a cappella neoconservative Republican media chorus popped up on Fox News and airwaves across America saying, incorrectly as it turned out, that the enhanced torture techniques used under the Bush administration had somehow led the Navy SEALs to Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. All right? And that then became a way of mounting political pressure. Very quickly, our Attorney General, Eric Holder, announced that the investigations into more than 100 cases of CIA abuse had found no case to answer, and except of 2 deaths in custody, the investigations would be ended. And recently, Attorney General Holder has announced that he would not prosecute for those 2 deaths in custody. The fifth and final stage is actually very recent, and that's rewriting history so that the fabric of the past is reconstructed, radically reconstructed, to justify the use of torture. And this came on the 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in August of last year, when Dick Cheney published his memoirs saying that the enhanced torture techniques used against this detainee, Abu Zubaydah, who was the first detainee subjected to them, turned this hardened terrorist into a, he said, fount of information, giving us information that led us to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and that saved thousands, if not tens, hundreds of thousands of American lives. Okay? 2 weeks later, however, okay, a former FBI counterintelligence operative named Ali Soufan published his memoirs in which he recounted the fact that he was there. He was the lead interrogator working on Abu Zubaydah in that Thai safe house that Cheney had referred to. And it turned out that it was not the CIA's enhanced torture techniques that extracted the information from Abu Zubaydah. Okay? It was Ali Soufan's ability, he's a Lebanese American, to speak to Abu Zubaydah fluently in Arabic. and conduct an empathetic interrogation that built up rapport, using information and intelligence to extract, you know, in a series of interrogations. And in fact, as soon as the Ali Sufan, the FBI, got the name Khalid Sheikh Mohammed out of Atazub Zaida, George Tenet pounded the table, got angry. He sent the top CIA psychologist, the man who had developed the enhanced techniques for the CIA, put him on an airplane with a CIA interrogation team, flew him out to the Bangkok safe house, and insisted that they take over the interrogation. And in four successive rounds, in an almost a scientific experiment, what would happen is the CIA would go in there, they'd rough up Abu Zubaydah, ramping up on this scale of increasingly harsh enhanced techniques. Abu Zubaydah would clamp up, then Ali Sufan would come in, speak to him in Arabic, establish rapport, turn off the noise, turn off the air conditioner, let him sleep, give him some food, and establish rapport, get more information. In four successive rounds, it established definitively CIA enhanced torture techniques do not work. FBI empathetic interrogation is very effective. If you look at Ali Sufan's book, there's 181 pages of CIA excisions that turn those parts, those chapters, right, into a maze, a rat's nest of black lines that no regular reader can understand. So this fundamental yet fragile truth has been kept from the American people.
Could you briefly analyze why you think there's such resistance to acknowledging the truth, that torture doesn't work, and that the kind of process you just described is so much more effective? Why is the CIA resisting that?
Yeah, this is an argument that I make in my book, Torture and Impunity. Torture is an extraordinary experience. We have a lot of information about what torture does to the victims. And we know that even no-touch torture, where a victim is subject to psychological techniques and is not actually physically maltreated, can nonetheless devastate the victim, disempower them for the rest of their lives unless they're given very sophisticated and appropriate psychological treatment. But what we don't have much information about is what it does to the perpetrators. And I argue, based on, you know, kind of recreating the torture moment in the Philippines between interviewing perpetrators and interviewing victims, is that torture empowers the perpetrator, turns the perpetrator into a kind of Nietzschean Superman, where the process of breaking a human being in the torture moment, so devastating for the victim, it seems to be a transactional process that simultaneously empowers the perpetrator. So these are not people that emerge from this experience and reflect and have remorse. They're empowered. They're determined to win impunity. And not just impunity, they're determined to win vindication for their techniques. And these are people that are the very apex of the national security apparatus in any society. And unless there is some external force, an empowered internal agency like a truth commission, to bring them to the bar of justice and to compel them to reflect, and that they will, okay, stride across the landscape empowered, manipulating, maneuvering to not only get away with torture, but also to have everybody tell them that these techniques were justified and necessary, and to demand honor and respect for their illegality.
What was it that caused you personally, distinguished professor of history at the University of Wisconsin, and now you've spent many years exposing and documenting torture and impunity, and what was it that motivated you to get involved in this difficult piece of your professional career? But what was it that got you involved in this to begin with?
It was meeting people on both sides of this transaction in the Philippines. In 1986, there was a world historical event called the People's Power Revolution in the Philippines that precipitated a wave of similar demonstrations disastrously at Tiananmen Square, triumphantly in Berlin and across Eastern Europe, right, in which people rose up against authoritarian regimes, not by taking up the gun and going to the countryside, but massing in the cities with their bodies against the tanks and the guns of these authoritarian regimes on both sides of the Iron Curtain. As a specialist in the Philippines, right after this event, I went back to Manila and I interviewed the heroes of this event, a group of colonels who had precipitated the uprising against Marcos by launching a mutiny. And what I found very quickly is these were strange men. There was something eerie and odd about them. I began looking into their records, and I found out in local human rights groups that these people were not conventional line officers. They weren't intelligence officers. They were internal security officers. They'd been running the safe houses. They had been torturing people. And then, through extraordinary circumstances, I happened to meet one of the victims, one of the most articulate of the victims of this brutality, a woman named Maria Elena Ang. She actually sought me out. I was then teaching in Australia, and she came to Australia from the Philippines. She knocked on my door unannounced and sat down and described her experiences to me. And the combination of meeting these eerie characters, these great heroes of this world historical event, supposedly, and then meeting the victim and seeing how utterly shattered she was by the experience, and getting, of course, her testimony about that experience, you know, led me into this realm of inquiry to kind of explore both sides of the equation and try and understand what is the real meaning of torture? What does it really do to a society? And it's a small act that has profound implications for a society, twists a society into incredible trauma and legal knots that take a generation to untie. So it was in the Philippines, still in Rizal today, and so it is in the United States.
You dedicate your book, Torture and Impunity, to Maria Elena Ang, and you tell her story, or she tells her story in the book. It's just an extraordinarily important book, Professor McCoy. Torture and Impunity, the U.S. Doctrine of Coercive Interrogation. The University of Wisconsin published this book in paperback. I think for every American that cares about this country, they should get this book and read it and absorb the profound lessons that Al McCoy so ably explains in the book. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. The thief, he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate. So let us not talk falsely now, the hour is getting late. Kept the view while all the women came and went, barefoot servants too. Outside in the distance, a wild cat did growl. Two riders were approaching, the wind began to howl.
The Massachusetts chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, along with the ACLU, recently issued a report detailing how the Boston Police Department has worked with its local fusion center to spy on lawful activities of protesters. The fusion center was established in the wake of 9/11 to more effectively share so-called terrorism-related information among federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, as well as with private entities.
Public police records, including documents and videotapes obtained with a court order, reveal a pattern of police surveillance of peaceful demonstrations in Boston, coupled with the practice of interrogating activists and labeling peaceful groups as extremists. Local groups and activists had long suspected that such spying was taking place. Joining us to talk about the report findings is Ursula Masny-Latos, Executive Director of the Massachusetts National Lawyers Guild. Welcome, Ursula, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
The National Lawyers Guild in Massachusetts has long worked with activists, and especially during the recent Occupy protests, you worked very closely in defending them. Why did you work with the ACLU in requesting information on the fusion centers?
We know that various law enforcement agencies monitor peaceful activists. This is something that they've been doing forever, even though a co-intel program ended in the 70s. However, we know that law enforcement agencies have continued spying. What we have found is the scope of this spying that surprised even us. What happened was in 2009, when Israel attacked Gaza, there were many protests in Boston, and one of those protests happened at the Israeli consulate. During that protest, four activists were arrested. The National Lawyers Guild represented those activists, and eventually charges against them were dropped. However, those activists came to us and told us that while being in jail, they were interviewed by three, four officers who did not really identify themselves. So those activists didn't know exactly who those officers were. They were in plain clothes, and the activists thought that they were just Boston Police Department officers.
What kinds of questions were they asking activists?
Each of them was interviewed individually, and questions they were posed were very problematic, in our opinion. For example, each of them was asked what organizations they're involved in, how often they meet, who comes to those meetings, what they discuss at those meetings, if there is anything planned, what they think about some organizations, what they think about some activists. One of those activists was even threatened because she refused to answer any questions. She just turned her chair and away from the officers, and she refused to answer any question. So they start intimidating her and threatening her.
With arrest or further detention?
With like, oh, if you play this game, we might charge you with intimidation of witnesses. So for someone who was just arrested and is in jail, those kind of questions are very intimidating. But and each of them was interviewed for like 20, 30 minutes. So we knew that those interviews happen. We requested reports from those interviews. The department responded with only one sentence, saying there are no reports because there were no interviews. So we sent an official letter asking for, because I just called the department, and then we sent a letter, and the letter also was answered with a very simple statement that there are no reports because there were no interviews. So after that, we file a FOIA request for each of those four activists, and our FOIA requests were not answered in a satisfactory way. We got statements from them saying that for security purposes, they cannot release any documents. And then after going back and forth for almost a year, we finally received from them just arrest reports, which were very standard, nothing significant when you look at it first. But then when I went over those documents several times, I noticed one sentence on one page. It was the last sentence, small, fine rook, and it said that for BRIC officers, interviewed those activists. BRIC is one of two fusion centers that we have in Massachusetts, and it stands for Boston Regional Intelligence Center. After that, I called the department and I asked for brick reports from those interviews. And a lawyer from the Boston Police Department told me that Brick was not involved in this arrest because this is really not Brick's work. And we know that fusion centers are not supposed to gather information or evidence from activists or anyone else. This is not really their mission. This became very uncomfortable, and after, again, several months and several conversations, the Boston Police Department admitted that, yes, Brick officers contacted those four activists, but there were no interviews. They just introduced themselves and said that they were available for any contact if those activists wish to contact them. So there was this huge discrepancy because we have four activists who are telling us that each of them was interrogated, and then we have the Boston Police Department saying us that no, it's not true, that the fusion center was not involved and there was no interrogation. So just after that, we partner with the ACLU here in Boston, and we decided to file a lawsuit against the Boston Police Department and Brick for refusing to release documents. And as a result of this lawsuit, the department was forced to release some documents. And over the last year, we have received many documents that have showed to us patterns that we consider, we find very, very problematic.
Let's just summarize. This whole process has gone on for well over a year. Has it been nearly 2 years from from the initial interviews to getting this information?
Yes.
Were the reports that you got heavily redacted?
Not heavily. They were redacted a little bit. Those reports, even though each of those reports was labeled or put in a category as either domestic terrorism or criminal or extreme. However, when you read those documents, those reports, they have information about peaceful activities. So there is really nothing there that would incriminate anyone involved.
But they've labeled these individuals as extremists or other categories.
Exactly. So there's this incredible discrepancy that on one hand, BRIC officers who are filing suspicious activities reports on either organizations or individuals and label them as extremist or domestic terrorism or criminal, but then they report on peaceful activities. So it was almost like, I don't want to use this word, but it was almost comic because you have a description of a peaceful march, peaceful rally, but on top of it, there is this label that it's put there, and the label says that it's extreme or criminal.
Now, let me ask you this. Are the activists who are involved in those interviews and any other ones who might be covered under some of the groups who were spied on and monitored, are they going to take legal action of any sort as a result of this?
We will have a large meeting here in Boston soon. There are several organizations that were either plaintiffs in our lawsuit and others that have learned about our findings, and everyone is very concerned. And there is a call for a large community meeting at which the NLG members, people from the ACLU, will be discussing, you know, what options we have. So we will look into some legal actions that might be taken, but we will also look what we should do as members of the public against this very, very severe spying that is going on, not only in Boston. People have to be very aware of it. Fusion centers have been put in all states. We right now have 77 fusion centers. No one knows exactly how many of those centers exist. But their role is really to spy and conduct surveillance on the public.
That's right. And in fact, their funding depends very much on coming up with sort of leads about so-called terrorism activity. So, as you know, we've seen this over the last decade. Local funding is poured into different entities who have to justify getting that funding.
Exactly.
Now, was the NLG mentioned in any of these reports?
No, those reports were about when we file this lawsuit, we listed what documents we want, and we wanted documents on all our plaintiffs. So among our plaintiffs, we had four individuals that were arrested in 2009, and then there were organizations such as Veterans for Peace, United for Justice and Peace, Pink Code. They're all well-established, peaceful organizations that we have here in Boston, and they also have their chapters around the country.
Knowing, as you and I do so well, that the Guild was spied on decades ago by the FBI, we sued, we settled, they admitted that for a couple of decades they tapped our phones, they had infiltrators. Knowing that history, is there any possible interest down the road in submitting FOIA requests to see if your chapter has been spied on?
Our litigation committee has been looking into it. So hopefully we will continue and decide soon.
You've issued a report called BRIC and the Policing of Dissent. Is that being distributed locally to organizations?
Yes, we have posted it on our website, so those interested can go to our website and read the report. Our website address is nlgmass.org. So those interested can go to our website and find all documents that we have received from the Boston Police Department and BRIC, and also people can find our report. In addition to documents and the report, we also have some video footage that we obtain under FOIA, and this footage shows how Boston police officers and BRIC officers spy and what kind of activities they monitor. And we also have a short video from a training that happened in Boston just before the first raid of Occupy Boston. December 2011.
Since the issuance of your report and your obtaining of all these documents and videos, have you had any contact with the local police department?
No. We also, last week, we issued a letter to the Boston Police Commissioner, Ed Davis, and in the letter we explain what we found in the documents released under FOIA, and also what we consider as very problematic. And in that letter, we ask the commissioner for a meeting. We have not been contacted by the commissioner's office with any dates of a possible meeting. So we are still waiting. We will definitely follow up on it. But there has been no contact between us and our office and the police department.
Ursula Masny-Latos, we thank you so much for joining us. And we thank you for this critical work, which, as you mentioned, is not just unique to Boston and Massachusetts. It's a national problem.
Thank you very much for having me. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
O sele. Mi gbo dada. Mi ti gbo. Ese.